You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, December 7th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello.
So, Evan, December 10th, what is infamous about this day?
In 1901, which was 110 years ago.
How do you figure?
Oh, you know, it's this calendar thing.
Today, Saturday, today.
December 10, 1901. The first Nobel Prizes ever are awarded in Stockholm, Sweden, in the fields of physics, chemistry, medicine, literature, and peace.
How'd that work out?
Well, you know, 110 years later, here we are. And
I wonder why the Nobel Prize became so iconic, you know, so important. Was it the only prize of its kind given at the time, or what separated it out from any other prizes?
Perhaps it was prestigious in its own right because of the people that it means to honor and celebrate for their achievements. I mean,
anybody could say, "Are we giving the Joe Blow Award to the best, you know, scientist in the world?"
Yeah, but Joe Blow didn't invent dynamite,
right? And there's a million Joe Blows out there, but there's only one Marie Curie. There's only one George Bernard Shaw.
No, you're missing my point, Evan. Anybody can give a prize to Marie Curie for what she did.
Yeah, but anybody didn't invent TNT.
Yeah, yes, that was it. Was it Nobel's?
In his own right, he was famous. I mean,
because it seemed to be very quickly the Nobel Prize became very prestigious.
I think it's the money. There was a ton of money even when it first started. That'll get people's attention. You don't need to have a big name if you're giving out a ton of money.
Then it just took on a life of its own, I guess. But yeah, money's. I guess that must have been a huge draw. I'd be curious to compare it to what other cash prizes might have been around for similar prizes back then, if there even were any.
Well, let's go on to a few news items. First, a quick update on Kevin Trudeau. You guys remember this character?
Absolutely.
He's still around?
Still around. Trudeau is essentially a merchant of nonsense and pseudoscience who sold Coral Calcium, I think was his first real infomercial adventure. And he was essentially convicted by the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, for committing fraud, and then could no longer sell stuff with infomercials. Since he couldn't sell stuff, he decided to sell information because that's free speech, and the FTC couldn't keep him from doing that. So he started to sell things like books. The natural cures, quote-unquote, they don't want you to know about. The weight loss cure, they don't want you to know about. He still got into trouble for doing that because he was making misleading claims about, I think, the cost of what he was selling on the infomercials.
Well, I think it was the weight loss thing that finally put him away because he made specific claims that were actually impossible, like saying that his plan would take only 4 weeks or something when the last step of the plan was do this the rest of your life, things like that.
Well, and also it was dangerous too. At one point he was having people go on amazingly restrictive calorie diets, right?
I don't think that it was any inherent danger that was what busted him. I mean, he's done plenty of dangerous things, particularly with the cancer cures one. But it was specifically the weight loss one in that he made very specific claims that could be tested and proved to be impossible. And those are the claims that ended up putting him away. Kind of like, what's his name? The gangster getting put away for tax evasion.
It's Capone.
He misrepresented the efficacy of his product is the bottom line. He was convicted and fined $37.6 million. And recently, the news is that recently that fine was upheld on appeal by the 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago. Upheld the $37.6 million fine. There was one change to the judgment. Initially, the FTC essentially banned Trudeau from infomercials, which I think is reasonable. They altered that to say that, well, you can't, that Trudeau can produce infomercials, but before he does so, he has to give the FTC a $2 million bond, as essentially as a guarantee that he won't commit fraud. And if he does, the FTC will keep the $2 million.
What crap.
So he makes $10 million and gives them two.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I think the bond is a good idea. I think the amount is too low, but I think the bond itself is not a bad idea in terms of protecting free speech, you know, allowing someone, like, okay, you can have the chance to go on TV and sell something if you want, but you can't.
I think it's an assault on free speech, actually.
Yeah.
I don't think the FTC should be doing this at all. Right? I mean, they shouldn't be saying, yeah, you say whatever you want, but you're going to pay a fine if it's going to be something that, you know, is misleading or something like that. I think that's an overextension of FTC power, frankly, federal power.
But they're not
power.
Saying that he can say whatever he wants. They're saying that he has to abide by the law or
okay.
else they
and if
keep
he doesn't,
his
he has
money.
To, he has to give up the bond. I get that.
Well, he gives
right?
up the bond and presumably they'll prosecute him.
The FTC can regulate commercial speech, Evan. This is commercial speech.
Yeah, and it's exactly like someone getting out of jail. Not to say that I think Trudeau has earned any amount of trust, but I can see how, you know, I see their point. Like, you don't want to ban people, for doing one wrong thing. So make them put up a bond so that you can ensure.
But
I do
believe in the three strikes you're out rule, though. I mean, he's a serial con artist.
He is to those of us who know better, but is this the first time that he's actually been convicted of anything criminal?
Well, he did definitely for the Coral Calcium, and now this would be the second. I don't know if this, I think there's been other things even in the past as well. It's like Dennis Lee, you know, who is a serial convicted, this free energy and other products.
Yeah, multiple times.
And multiple states have banned him from selling stuff in the state or soliciting for investments. One state's attorney said that he was a menace to the investing public and you can't do business in our state.
Okay, yeah, I've changed my mind.
They have the right and the power to protect the public from people who have demonstrated that this is it. This guy is a psychopath or whatever, in my opinion.
Yeah, he's proven that his intent is to do no good. Or that's basically the result of what he does.
Yeah, I disagree. This doesn't do that. $2 million bond. Like Bob said, so he makes $10 million, $20 million. Don't they look at his past history and see how much and how insignificant a number like that is? They should make him post a $100 million bond if they're really going to make it. I mean,
I
dissuade
agree.
Him from even making
Yeah, the original the judgment of just the flat-out ban was probably better. But, you know, I'm not sure why.
Yeah, and I think that the $37 million fine is too low. He should be in jail, I think, but based on the Cancer Cures book.
So you know he has a new product thing. Called Your Wish is Your Command, which it's basically
the secret thing.
Yeah, it's a secret.
Is it a bottle and you rub it?
he really is, I think. I mean, I am not a psychologist. He is totally a psychopath. I mean, I think he's identified another ripe audience in the Alex Jones audience, you know, the conspiracy theorists, kind of raging loony bin types. And now he's focused on them. He's doing a lot of conspiracy nonsense, a lot of the secret, just
but,
all
but
of
isn't
that
it
stuff
obvious
now.
That he is sitting around hatching plans? I mean, this isn't the guy that's actually believing in this stuff. I mean, he's coming up with these varied things that are moneymakers.
You can't read their minds, obviously, but yeah, he has all the red flags of a deliberate con artist versus a true believer, in my opinion.
What would it take? What would he actually have to do to be banned permanently?
Yeah, if this guy, if he's not a, you know, didn't cross the line, I don't know who did. I mean, he was incarcerated for fraud in the early 1990s. Then he gets out and runs a multi-level marketing, firm, which was charged with running a pyramid scheme. And then he goes on to late night television selling his Coral Calcium diet supplements. And then he goes into the alternative medicine thing, then the debt cures, and now the wish for whatever you want. I mean, the pattern is obvious, right?
Yeah, so this isn't someone who's trying to educate the public even ignorantly.
To put this into context, his original conviction was for posing as a doctor in order to deposit $80,000 in false checks. He pleaded guilty to larceny.
Oh,
in the same year, he faced charges for credit card fraud. So he started out with, petty credit card and check fraud. And then graduated to these schemes. So, I mean, this is what we're dealing with.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he's a career criminal.
And it's amazing that people like that can go on to, you know, so many people can believe in him. And
that's an incredible thing. I had a conversation with somebody that I know, an acquaintance, who read his Natural Cures book and believed it hook, line, and sinker. And I couldn't convince him that this guy was a con artist. You know, it was unbelievable.
It's amazing. Really?
Well, what did you say to them?
I gave
them
the whole story. But they were just, I don't know, they were just so dazzled by what he wrote in the book that they just didn't make an impression on them. It's like, really? The guy was convicted of credit card fraud. You don't think that that says something about his character? Please, I mean, just
his integrity.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on. Bob, you're going to tell us about probing outer space.
This past week was rife with alien probe news, not the kind involved in those close encounters with horny aliens. I'm talking about probes that we send to alien worlds within our solar system, obviously. This includes the Curiosity probe, which NASA just launched to Mars, the New Horizons probe on its way to Pluto, and the Voyager 1 probe, which is at the outskirts of our solar system. Now, for me, the real big news this week was the successful launch of the Mars Curiosity probe. So we talked about this last week. I want to give a few more details that I've learned. The Curiosity probe just went up, as we said. It's going to land this summer in the northern hemisphere anyway. And the goal for this $2.5 billion machine is to find some sort of Martian microbial life, if it ever gained a foothold on Mars, or even if it still might even be there, which, of course, would be amazing. What really surprised me, though, was just how incredible this probe really is. It's one website described it as containing the biggest, most advanced suite of instruments for scientific studies ever sent. It's actually five times heavier than the last rover that went to Mars. So this is just so beefy. It's about three meters long and wide, and of course it's nuclear powered, which they pretty much all are these days. It's just loaded with like 10 different scientific instruments. It's even got a jackhammer at the end of its 2 meter arm, and of course it's got an HD camera and laser camera.
It's got a DVD player. It's got an HDTV.
Yeah, right. Even though all that is really cool, my favorite instrument is a laser torch. Is a laser torch that can vaporize rock at 23 feet away.
Awesome.
It's pretty amazing. Now, of course, it could only vaporize a pinhead-sized piece of rock, but still, I think that's really cool. But there was one thing, though, about this rover that really surprised the hell out of me. Do you know how this thing is going to land, guys?
Yeah, it's actually going to land with retro rockets.
So rockets like from the 60s and 70s.
It's like, well, it's too big. Remember the last couple of rovers had
the balloons.
They were like inside these balloons and it just kind of bounced around.
Bouncies.
This is way too heavy for that. And I assume it's too big for parachutes because the thin Martian atmosphere, I guess, would require really huge parachutes. This thing is actually going to have this platform. I guess it's going to be attached to this platform that's hovering over Mars using rockets. So it's going to be this stable rocket propelled platform that's kind of hovering, and it's going to be lowered down onto the surface of Mars. The name of this technique is called
retro rocketing,
hook, line, and sinker.
I'm not sure how to pronounce it. It's called abseiling. It's a German derived word which means repelling. I'm sure you know what repelling is. Yeah. So how did you pronounce it?
I think it's pronounced abseiling.
Okay, abseiling. So they're actually going to lower it. They're going to lower it onto the surface of Mars. And it's just so funny that I searched and searched and searched for news or anything about this technique. And I really couldn't find anything. They just like mentioned it as an aside. And, you know, but as cool as that is, it really makes me nervous because they've never done anything like this before. The other bit of news, with space probes is the New Horizons probe, which we've mentioned a bit. This probe has now officially become the closest of any man-made object ever to get to Pluto. The old record was about 1.6 billion kilometers set by Voyager 1 way back in 86. This is officially closer than that, and it's going to steadily get closer. I think it's actually going to get about 8,000 miles away at one point and be able to resolve a football field-sized object. So we're going to have this amazing, amazing high-res pictures of Pluto. I really can't wait. I think this is going to be about in 2015. And one other little interesting thing about New Horizons, it's one of the fastest machines ever built. It travels at about 55,000 kilometers per hour, which is about 35,000 miles per hour. So this thing is like 20 times faster than a speeding bullet.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Was there any mention about the moons of Pluto?
There was a concern, actually. You know, they found three – in the past 4 or 5 years, they found about three new moons that orbit around Pluto, or I guess they orbit around each other. And so they're kind of scared because they're not sure what the local environment's going to be like. And this thing, if this thing hits a little moonlit or whatever, it would just be smashed a bit. So I think the hope is that within a few years, they'll have a much better idea of what the local environment looks like around Pluto, so that they can actually kind of avoid anything really nasty happening to the probe. And then the final little bit here is Voyager 1. That had yet another news item. It's apparently the Voyager 1 has entered a new and even more obscure region of the outskirts of our solar system. I hadn't even heard of this one. This is called the Stagnation Zone. A Voyager project scientist at the California Institute of Technology recently had a really nice quote. He said, "Voyager is showing that what is outside is pushing back. We shouldn't have long to wait to find out what the space between stars is really like." So I think they're saying that Voyager 1 might actually enter officially interstellar space even a little bit sooner than they thought. Now, the deal with this stagnation zone is that the solar wind has calmed down a lot. The magnetic field that pervades our solar system is kind of piling up there, and the higher energy particles from within our solar system are kind of leaking out into interstellar space at this point. So I guess it's just a matter of time. I didn't see any estimates, but I would say within a few years or a couple years, it'll be officially in interstellar space.
Is this like the final membrane of what could be construed as the effect of our solar system?
I don't think it's the final one. It's pretty damn close, though.
And as you said before, we'll have to give an update on these probes as they reach their destinations. So we talked about jetpacks last week, and we can't talk about jetpacks without talking about cloning mammoths, because in the future, there will be mammoths flying around on jetpacks. So, Jay, how close are we getting to cloning a mammoth?
So the news is that scientists from Japan and Russia recently announced that they found a thigh bone.
Connected to a hip bone?
The thigh bone, they found it in August at this location. The first hurdle was they weren't sure if it was a woolly mammoth or a Wookiee thigh bone. They ruled out the Wookiee, which was good because it was
for not existing.
Yeah, well, that was one thing, but right. There had a lot of other things they tested against.
Isn't it more likely that it'd be that thing that was on Hoth tried to kill Luke? What was that called?
Not the Tauntaun, the ice monster.
Not a Tauntaun. The monster that tried to kill him.
The thing that looks like a white cookie monster.
Yeah.
Say what it is. It's Yeti.
Or like a bumble.
It would be one of those things that the Sandman rode on, because they looked like woolly mammoths, kind of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, but those weren't on Hoth, were they, Steve?
No, those were on Tatooine. Come on.
Right. No, that's a desert. This was in a zone where global warming had only just melted things enough to allow them access to the bones.
Well, now, but 10,000 years ago.
Still not a desert.
Yeah. It was
so
cold then, too.
Shut your mouth.
So in August, they found this thigh bone, this giant thigh bone of a woolly mammoth, and they found out that it actually has very well-preserved bone marrow in it. And Rebecca's right. They actually found this because the permafrost has been softening, and they're finding more and more stuff. You know, we've talked about this. Remember, months and months ago, we talked about artifacts showing up, out of the ice and snow?
Like the arrow, yeah.
Right, exactly. I can't remember the name of that weapon that, that was like a...
Atlatl.
Atlatl, yeah.
Atlatl, which is like Batman's Atlatl?
Atlatl.
Enough of your Star Wars terminology.
So in Siberia, at a place called Windy Cliffs, there's tons and tons of woolly mammoth bones. You literally could just walk around and find them. They're on the surface of the ground. They're sticking out. Yeah, it is cool. And I actually thought, while I was reading this and doing the research, about how awesome it would be to go there and just make a little collection for yourself and bring them home. I don't know if that's legal, but I would love to have a woolly mammoth
Probably
bone.
Not legal.
So the last mammoths lived there about 10,000 years ago, and that's basically the last time that mammoths existed on Earth was about 10,000 years ago.
No, they found evidence of mammoths from only 5,000 years ago as well in some isolated area. So it's tough to think that we were so close to seeing those bad boys.
Well, that's Bob, it's interesting you say that because, the older it is, the more that the the DNA will degrade and everything. But I'm sure that when they found those other bones that were much younger, that they were they looked. But I guess these were very well preserved because
they're
of
the
temperature.
Oh yeah.
So teams from the Saka Republic's Mammoth Museum and Japan's Kinki University will start this joint research in 2012, hoping to recreate a living mammoth. So they're going to use the same methodology that was used to create other cloned animals, like remember Dolly the sheep, dogs, cats, pigs, and monkeys have all been cloned with this process. And here I'll quickly go through what the process is. What they do is they replace the nuclei of the elephant, in this case, of an elephant egg, with the nuclei from a mammoth's marrow cell. And that alone is very difficult to do. There's a lot of like fixing they need to do, and you know they're stitching things together. They're trying to basically make the best version of the DNA as they can. They will produce a healthy embryo, and then that embryo, of course, will be containing the mammoth DNA, and then they put that into a mother elephant, into the womb, and hopefully, you know, it doesn't happen every time. It takes, you know, could be dozens of times before one of them will stick. And then, you know, a lot of times they'll have a birth and the animal will come out kind of screwed up. It dies, you know, very quickly or whatever. But, you know, they can and have proven in the past that this procedure does work successfully if done enough. So this technique is actually the only proven technique we have today to do it.
Well, there is another technique, Jay. It doesn't give you a mammoth as quickly, but what you do is you rather than doing a cloning technique where you do a whole nucleus substitution, you essentially mate an elephant with a mammoth. You cross the
DNA.
Don't
you need a mammoth for that?
Yeah, no, well, you do it like in a petri dish, obviously. You know, you fertilize with the DNA from the
But then
the
you would have a crossbreed.
Yes.
You wouldn't have an actual mammoth.
Exactly.
Which destroys the point.
You have a half mammoth, half elephant. But then you keep doing that and you get closer and closer to a mammoth. But the advantage of that is that you do have a full set of normal DNA to help keep it healthier and to, you know, plug any holes and stuff. So it's more likely to get a viable, you know, live birth that way than with the whole cloning. But you do get a hybrid, and then it would take, you know, multiple iterations to get closer and closer to an actual mammoth.
It's a hybrid.
The thing is, like, these researchers are saying 5 years. That's absolutely not going to happen. Like, I don't like being the pessimistic one, but I will gladly put down $100 to say that these researchers will not clone a woolly mammoth in 5 years. Because previous efforts to clone extinct species have taken far longer than that and failed utterly. The ibex, for instance, it took like 9 years in 2009, I think, or 2010. They cloned one and it lasted less than 10 minutes before it died. So
it's a good
actually,
10 minutes.
Yeah, I'm sure it really enjoyed those 10 minutes. Like, I'm alive. My species continues.
Yeah, it's like the whale and
and then
Hitchhiker's Guide.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, he's talking as he's falling. Oh, and I'm alive. What is this? Oh,
right. An ibex in a flower pot falling through the sky. So
it's tough to do.
Like, first they have to. Yeah, like let's say that they actually do manage to create a mammoth, and that not only do they get one, they get an elephant pregnant with a mammoth, and the mammoth gets born, and then let's say they manage to keep it alive for the first hour. How are they going to then, first of all, make it thrive, you know, and then how are they going to continue the species? You know, they would have to hope and pray that whatever other birth they get is of the opposite sex. And even then, you know, they would have to hope that they would be able to mate. I mean, it's just...
You know, Rebecca, nobody said it was going to be easy. I mean, you know, you don't only pursue science if it's
well,
easy.
Actually, that's what I take issue with, is the headlines of saying, like, we're going to have woolly mammoths in 5 years. No, we're not. No. We're just not. That's not going to happen. At the very best, we'll get one deformed lump of mammoth spewing forth from an elephant's vagina, and then it will promptly die.
Oh my God! Really?
Like, but that's
think
that's
about
the
how
reality.
The woolly mammoth would feel if
that's
you know,
the reality. You know, it's
I don't know.
It's not that. That's my problem, is that they're trying to make it sound like, oh, this is an easy thing. We found the DNA, which we don't even know for sure that they have. You know, we know that they found some viable specimens, but we don't know that they've actually managed to extract any completely intact DNA. But let's assume they did. Like, even then, like the headlines are suggesting, oh yeah, we got the DNA. Now it's just a matter of knocking up an elephant. When, in fact, it's much, much, much more difficult than that.
Yeah, they definitely are taking more of the positive outlook and everything. But every article I read definitely gave a more critical point of view, definitely voiced the opinion of someone that was saying, you know, I don't really think it's going to be as easy as that. Or even one of the articles I read, one of the scientists was basically saying, this is ridiculous. You know, even if we could do it, why would we do it? So they're giving other points of view. I don't think they did that much of a fail as I typically see, because I do think that the scientists that are conducting this are have a healthy dose of reality as well. Like, they're saying it's possible we could get there. They're working on it. They're enthusiastic about it. But I didn't hear anyone basically say that absolutely for 100% sure they're going to have these things and there's going to be, you know, zoos of them all over the place. I didn't read that anywhere.
I'm just saying that the headlines were
They were overselling.
For my taste.
But maybe, who knows, 20, 30, 40 years.
Misleading science headlines.
Yeah, you know, we may have zoos filled with woolly mammoths and woolly rhinos and other things.
Yeah, and I would love that. And I am optimistic that that will happen.
Right away. In fact, the personal jetpack. One more news item, and this is also something that we've talked about from time to time on the show, exoplanets. It seems like we're discovering new exoplanets every day almost. Hundreds have been discovered, especially with the Kepler satellite up there. And one thing that the news media has a fun time tracking, and I have a fun time tracking, quite honestly, is every time we discover an exoplanet that's more Earth-like than any previously discovered exoplanet, we are creeping closer and closer to finding a planet that is a true twin to the Earth. And we've got, I think, with Kepler-22b, I think we're getting pretty darn close. You guys read about this?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty cool.
It's everywhere. It's all over the news.
Kind of big, but still.
Yeah, it's a little big. So it's 2.4 times the size of the Earth. Yeah, so that's the radius, size and radius. Its gravity, they're saying, the gravity would be, at the surface, would be 2.4 times that of the Earth.
A little hard walking around.
Well, I guess it still depends on what the density is. So I guess it's... If it has Earth-like density, then the surface gravity would be 2.4 times the Earth. But it could be less than that. It could be less than that. Its surface temperature is a balmy 72 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's fascinating.
Wow,
to me.
Nice.
That,
yeah,
I like.
So it's comfortable.
Liquid water.
Yeah, so it's, yeah, it could potentially have liquid water on the surface.
Better.
Its orbital period, the amount of time it takes to go around its star, is 289.9 days, just about 290 days. So it's a little bit closer to its star than the Earth, but the star is a little bit dimmer, so it averages out to be pretty much exactly in the sweet spot of the Goldilocks zone. Of course, we don't know how much of a greenhouse effect it's getting from its atmosphere. It really depends on what the atmosphere is like. It could be a lot hotter, could be a lot colder. The fact that it's far from its star, it's, you know, farther than Venus, but not as far as the Earth from its star, is good, because that means it's probably not tidally locked. I guess it still could be, but it's less likely to be tidally locked with the Sun. So remember, a lot of the Earth-like, quote unquote Earth-like planets that we've discovered so far that are, you know, like super Earths, or like 2 to 3 times the size of the Earth, are
really close.
Really close. Yeah, like their orbital period is hours or days. And they would be definitely tidally locked, which means one side of the planet would always face the star, which would not really be a good, a conducive condition for,
so you probably,
for life.
So you probably have a band around the planet that would...
Yeah, there could be that twilight band, you know, between the day and the night side that could have reasonable conditions. But this is better. This is a planet at a reasonable distance with, you know, a 290 day year, probably, you know, depending on its atmosphere and its exact density, could have features that are pretty similar to Earth. Might not be. One of the news items I read said, oh, before you think that this would be a great world for people to colonize, you know, it's 600 light years away. It's like, I wasn't really thinking about colonizing the star.
Plus, the gravity would be totally oppressive.
I'm more interested in finding a plant that has its own life on it. You know what I mean? Not sending Earth, not human there, humans there are colonizing it, but finding a planet where that actually has life on it. So the next thing we need to do is to examine its atmosphere spectroscopically. Imagine if we could document that it has water vapor and oxygen in the atmosphere.
Oh, oxygen.
Yeah, so oxygen would not hang around unless it was being replenished. The best process that we know about for pumping oxygen into the atmosphere is life. It's metabolism. So that would be a pretty strong piece of evidence that there was life on the planet. Of course, it could just all be the equivalent of bacteria. Doesn't mean that there would be...
Still be cool.
Yeah, still be awesome. But it doesn't mean, yeah, it doesn't necessarily translate to a civilization. So yeah, this is, you know, of any exoplanet that we've heard about so far, this one is the best prospect for life.
It's really far away.
Yeah, who cares?
And it's all right. Everything
very unlikely
is.
That, hey, I'm just saying, you know, so it's cool, but it's not like we're going to be going.
We're not going to be going anywhere soon. Not even going to be going to the closest, you know, stars anytime soon.
Why so pessimistic?
So 600 light years, 6 light years, it doesn't make any difference at this point with our current technology. It's just as inaccessible.
Right.
My prediction is it's not going to rain for very long as the most Earth-like exoplanet. I think we're going to keep finding ones that are closer in size and, you know, orbital characteristics to the Earth. All right, well, let's go on to Who's That Noisy, Evan? Tell us about last week's Who's That Noisy.
I suppose we should play it again and...
I suppose
if we have to. Here it is.
We're behind.
There's a lot of guys, and I've debated that one guy, that Phil Plate from Battleship. I clowned that guy.
Clowned him. Whatever that means.
So everyone knew who this guy was.
Joe Rogan.
He used a Gish Gallop on Phil to ask him more questions than could possibly be answered in the time allotted. And he's also a loudmouth, which also helps in any argument, of course.
Well, let's give the background, you know, a little bit more background. This is for the Pendulet podcast, a radio show. There were two episodes where Joe Rogan and Phil Plait debated the moon hoax.
The particular clip I took was not from either of those, though, but that's what he was alluding to.
Yeah, he's talking about those two episodes. In the first encounter, Phil wiped the floor with him. There's no question about that. In the second one, Rogan just got more and more obnoxious and just gave Phil, as Jay said, the Gish Gallop, where he just kept throwing stuff out. He also said things that were not true. I listened to the whole thing, and
well, yeah, that's part and parcel of the Gish Gallop.
Well, yeah, but it's just like flat out factually incorrect. He said that the director of NASA quit one day before the first Apollo mission launched. That was not true. He resigned a year before, which is not at all unusual. You know, people resign from posts like that. But saying it was like the day before Apollo, that does seem odd. And that's the whole conspiracy strategy there, which is just to throw out things which are sound odd and then cast them in as sinister a light as possible, even though you don't close the loop on it, right? You don't have evidence that, for example, like in this case, that he resigned because he knew it was a hoax and he couldn't go through with it. I mean, those are the implications. But it's just making sinister implications from seemingly anomalous or weird facts, even if you have to change those facts to make them seem anomalous. The other thing that Rogan, I think, really surprised Phil about was when he said that NASA had sent people to Antarctica to find moon rock meteorites, as if, what they said they brought back from the moon were actually meteorites that they collected in Antarctica. Why did they do that? Why would they do that? You know, just try to, again, make it sound really sinister. But that's a ridiculous claim for multiple reasons. You know, the meteorites collected from Antarctica are, we go there because they're easily visible on the ice, but the amount of moon-derived or lunar-derived meteorites that we've collected, that the world has collected, is much less than, over the last 40 years, much less than the pounds of moon rocks that NASA brought back from the moon during the Apollo missions. But also, meteorites are easy to tell from rocks that we brought back from the moon. When they go through the atmosphere, it changes the outside of the meteorite. On the other hand, rocks from the surface of the moon have these pitting from micrometeorites, the kind of thing that can only happen in a vacuum, in on the surface of a world without an atmosphere. So it's not like a lunar meteorite and a rock taken from the surface of the moon would not look at all alike. They would have similar chemical compositions. That's how we know that they're from the moon, because of the chemical signature. But the geological characteristics are completely different. The idea that NASA somehow fooled the world's geologists with their fake moon rocks over the last 40 years is absurd. But again, like, Rogan wouldn't commit himself to anything. He says, "I'm just asking questions. Just asking questions."
Yeah, right.
That's a way of saying, "I'm just throwing out superficial factoids, but don't want to be held to any detailed analysis of what they actually mean." That's what he means by "I'm just asking questions." And now he's going around saying that he cleaned Phil's clock. That's really sleazy of him to do that.
Hence, he was the subject of "Who's That Noisy?" Because...
So where was he being interviewed? Where was he saying that?
The world must know. The Man Cow Show. Radio host Man Cow as a syndicated national show. He was being interviewed by Man Cow.
Man Cow?
Man Cow, that's his...
That's his idiot that said he was going to get waterboarded like Christopher Hitchens and then lied about it
or something. Oh, is that right?
Yeah, he's, you know, shock jock kind of personality. Yeah.
I know 100 people guessed it, but who got it first?
From the message boards, A-L-H. Al-H. Al-H. He's got a cute little rabbit here as an avatar icon. Avatar number one on it. So congratulations.
And what do you got for this week?
This week's Who's That Noisy. All right, pay attention. Listen closely. And indulge yourself in Who's That Noisy.
That's me learning to play the tuba.
Jay having sex.
That's me learning to play the tuba while Jay is having sex.
In the other room, yeah.
That was an interesting one, Evan.
Very interesting, yep. Yep. So, you know, put on your thinking caps, search around the internet, see what you can find. Give it your best guess. Good luck to everyone.
All right. Thanks, Evan. Well, let's move on to your questions and emails. We actually have a couple of corrections and clarifications this week. The first one, Rebecca, has to do with an offhand comment you made in a recent episode about casinos. We were talking about the fact that that's still the place where you get exposed to a lot of secondhand smoke.
Yes, I inadvertently helped spread a myth, a myth that I had heard before, but had completely forgotten about. So we're talking about smoke in casinos, and I mentioned that it's still a problem, even though the casinos pump. I think what I said was, even with all the oxygen casinos are pumping in. And I forgot that there is this myth that casinos pump in oxygen to make you feel higher and to cause you to spend more money. I, in the moment, had actually misspoken, and what I was conveying was that the smoke is still a problem despite all of the airflow, because casinos have super badass air conditioning systems that, particularly the casinos in Vegas, of course, because of, you know, the desert. But they have these giant HVAC units that help circulate the air because they allow smoking, and as a way to make that not a problem for their non-smoking guests, they tend to have really good air circulation. But I find that it's not usually good enough. That's what I was talking about, but I accidentally said oxygen instead of air, which helped to spread this dumb myth that casinos make you high on oxygen in order to make you spend more money. So let me just state for the record that that is in fact a myth. Casinos
That is not true.
Casinos do not pump oxygen.
I heard that last week on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
They lied. They're liars. God, don't believe everything you hear, Jay.
Oh, I mean, all right, okay.
Yes, that would be prohibitively expensive and possibly illegal for casinos to do.
And I did read that that casinos do try to keep it a little chilly in the casino because that's stimulating.
Makes the waitress's nipples hard.
Yeah, that's just a side benefit. I don't know how true that was, but it seemed to be taken as fact that they do that. The other thing that happened last week, despite my best efforts to correct this myth as you guys were generating it about the extruded meat.
What are you talking about?
So last week we talked about the fact we were correcting one myth about dyeing tomato juice, and you brought up the fact, Jay, that chicken nuggets are often made from this extruded meat.
Yeah.
Mechanically separated
meat.
Bleached and all that.
Yeah, so I corrected the myth that like the whole chicken is used. And in fact, it is just all the edible bits are taken off the bone. And it does get a little bit more meat content off out of the animal because you're using every last bit of edible, meat and tendon and skin and everything.
Like the Indians used to do.
Yeah, rather, but it does not include beak and bone and hooves or whatever else, depending on the animal used. And it is true that the result is a pink paste.
Goo.
It looks like you could see it coming out of the machine. It looks like like toothpaste or something in terms of its consistency. And that is used to make chicken nuggets, chicken patties,
hot dogs,
bologna, anything that's not real, not like meat.
You have a degree in bologna.
Yeah, not like
bologna, yes.
Anything that's obviously processed. Yeah, is often used in this way. I guess
processed frozen chicken.
My favorite is always luncheon meat. I mean, really? That's the best you could do?
Olive loaf.
You can't get any more specific than luncheon meat.
Yeah.
But Jay, a couple of times you said McNuggets, which are not all chicken nuggets. Yeah. McNuggets are specifically a product of McDonald's, and apparently McDonald's stopped using the mechanically separated meat in 2003, and now they use 100% white meat. So it's no longer true of chicken McNuggets. Although you could still buy chicken nuggets in the store that are made from mechanically separated meat.
See, I sort of blamed McDonald's for that mix-up because for me, for most of my life, I've had difficulty not saying chicken McNuggets when I mean chicken nuggets because I am a child of the 80s and my corporate culture.
So I don't see the point of you bringing this up. We're still talking about that pink paste.
Well, there were two things that we got wrong. One is saying McNuggets, I think, and the other was that I mentioned that they were cleaned with ammonia.
Yeah. When you say you mean you and Jay, right? I mean, I had no part of this incompetence.
Yes. yes, you are absolved, Evan.
Thank you.
And the other one is that I said that they were cleaned in ammonia, which is not true, and I apologize. Apparently, because ammonia is used in refrigeration, there have been several times where food has been contaminated with it due to breaks in hoses and whatnot around the refrigeration units. But it's not purposely doused in ammonium.
Right. But it is often dyed and flavored. But
yes,
that should not be any big surprise.
So I can't be like, well, I was using this Q-tip the other day. Nope. I have to say like a cotton swab on this show, right? Okay.
That's right.
All right. I'll
Band-Aid.
I'll keep that straight.
Yeah. Kleenex. Xerox. Rollerblade. Okay. Let's move on.
Cock ring.
Right.
But the
wait,
but
what?
At its core,
I'm sure our lawyers would tell us that, yes, you do need to be careful not to mention brand names when you don't
need
to.
That's exactly right.
Okay. That's fine. But at its core, though, I was conveying some very useful information.
No, it is interesting. The whole extruded meat, pink meat paste is interesting. It is.
I got several emails of people that listened to the show that were equally horrified and wanted to start a club, and we're working on it.
Okay. The meat paste club?
Meat paste club.
We're sitting here now at TAM 9 with Dr. Lawrence Krauss. Lawrence Krauss, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
It's nice to be back, and in fact, not virtually, but in reality, too.
That's right. Yeah, that's one of the things we love about coming to TAM is that we get to meet people that we just interviewed before. We get to see them in person. And
it's always a disappointment, isn't it? No. Yeah.
The face-to-face interviews are always better, in our opinion. But I caught your panel, I think it was yesterday, on space exploration. Where do we go after NASA? It was very provocative. I thought there was a lot of energy on the panel.
It was provocative. There was a lot of heat. I'm not sure how much light there was.
Okay. So why don't you tell us, tell our audience, where do you think after the shuttle, the shuttle will be landing, what is it, in a couple of days?
21st, I believe.
21st. And so then that the shuttle program is officially come to an end.
Yeah, it's time to celebrate the end of the program. And celebrate what that awful waste of $200 billion now no longer being spent.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And the program, the Orion program that was supposed to take in place was also canceled. Mm-hmm. And so here we are. We have no manned space program or person space program at this time. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, it's no great loss. What worries me a lot more is we're killing our unmanned space program. Mm-hmm. And as I tried to talk about in the panel, the Appropriations Committee has just recommended canceling the James Webb Space Telescope, which is the centerpiece of American astronomy and space for the next decade or two. It's the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope, and it's just been slated to be canceled. And that is a much greater devastation to space exploration than not having people orbit the Earth about the same distance between Boston and New York in a tin can. Learning about nothing except how people can orbit the Earth in a tin can. Mm-hmm. The bottom line is that much of what's been spent on human space exploration hasn't been any exploring at all in the last 30 years, and has really all we've ever learned is how people can live in space, in near space, not even far space. And it's got nothing to do with science. And it's been an incredible waste of money for the most part. Not completely, but for the most part. The International Space Station, which has cost over $100 billion, is something that every major scientific organization opposed. It has no scientific value at all. And the best use of it would be to see how big a splash it makes in the Pacific Ocean and if it were let go.
So how do you really feel?
How would we have fixed the Hubble Space Telescope, then?
Well, we could have put in, for the price of the four shuttle missions, we could have built two new Hubble Space Telescopes. So $1.5 billion a mission. And the bottom line is, right, it was nice to have it to fix it, but the Hubble Space Telescope was designed to be sent up in the shuttle. If we didn't have the shuttle, it would have been designed differently, just like the James Webb Space Telescope. So you're right, there were some mistakes when it was made on Earth, and it was nice to be able to fix those. But if you actually look at the clear cost of those repair missions, it's not obvious that there was any cost savings. And that's probably one of the... But nevertheless, it is true that repairing the space telescope is probably one of the few real scientific benefits of the space shuttle. But remember, it cost $200 billion. And you're talking about repairing a telescope that's maybe $3 billion. And the problem with human space exploration is that 99.9% of the money is spent on getting the humans there and back again alive, leaving very little to do anything useful. That doesn't mean we shouldn't do human space exploration, but in my opinion, if we were going to do it, we should do something interesting. What could be less interesting than having these people orbit, just above the Earth? That's why no one cares.
Right.
That's why no one cares at all. I mean, it's just boring. It's not only useless, but it's boring. If you're going to do something, at least do something interesting.
What?
Although I don't think there's a lot of utility for it, but if you want to learn how to build habitats elsewhere, you could put a station on the moon. But again, not for real scientific purposes particularly, and not for industrial purposes. All this stuff about using the moon for industry and stuff is just nonsense. It just costs too much money. But what we do want to do with astronauts is it's just exciting adventure. So we just realize, okay, we're willing to spend this much for adventure. We go to movies and but not pretend it's doing science, because when you do that, then the science part of NASA gets overwhelmed. So whenever there's a cost overrun in the space station or something else, you want to cut back in the science part. So if we just, I testified before Congress with Buzz Aldrin over a decade ago on this very subject. I said, be honest about it. The science doesn't involve humans. All the good science that NASA does doesn't involve humans. To first approximation, there's a set of measure zero that does, but very little. And the stuff involving humans is largely for exploration. Mm-hmm. Now, it's true that some of my geologist friends would say, well, you know, a human geologist on Mars could do what the rovers did in months in a day or so. But let's remember that for the price of a human mission to Mars, we could probably send 1,000 to 10,000 rovers, first of all. Mm-hmm. Secondly, if some of them die in the way, it's okay. Thirdly, it's true that right now a human geologist would be much more effective than a robot geologist, but it's not clear to me in 20 years that'll be the case. Mm-hmm. You can, and let's remember the original missions to Mars or the rovers cost as much as making a movie about sending Bruce Willis to Mars. Okay?
Yeah. Wow. Well, there's no doubt that when you start looking at things like movie costs versus mission costs and all that stuff, I agree with you, in other words, that, sure, the money is being spent in a lot of ridiculous ways. Mm-hmm. It blows my mind when I go and I see a horrible movie that costs $100 million. Like, that's a devastation to humanity as far as I'm concerned.
Well, if it makes money, it's not. I guess capitalism.
Right. But, that's private versus public. Yeah.
But I think there's something legitimate to be said about doing something for the public interest, doing something to excite people, to keep them involved. And I can see where you're saying we've been orbiting the Earth for a very long time. But I know when I was a kid, anything to do with outer space blew my mind.
I agree with you. Look, I stayed home from school from when the Apollo – I'm older than you. And the Apollo missions came. I stayed home from school. I had a little mission control in my basement. I mean,
awesome.
And absolutely, human space travel inspires people. And I think I said on stage yesterday that you know, I've been on stage many times with astronauts or in events with them, and they just people want to come up and touch them. I mean, it's really just they inspire people. And so human space exploration is inspiring. And I'd go in a second if you asked me. I'd love to. So that aspect is inspirational, and we should recognize that it's one of the things that helps excite kids about becoming scientists. So there is that aspect of human space exploration, and that's what I mean by adventure. I didn't mean to demean it. I think adventure is one of the more exciting things that people can do, and adventure in the explorational sense, maybe boldly going where no man or woman has gone before. But certainly that doesn't involve going into the same orbit as all sorts of junk that's there now.
Yeah.
So I do agree that it has an amazingly important role in inspiring people, but we should be honest about exactly what we can and cannot do. I also think the Hubble Space Telescope has played an amazingly important role in inspiring people. You know, every time I show a Hubble Space Telescope picture, you know, people hear, in the audience. And it's sad that the successor of that is being killed, because I think that's just as inspirational. And not only that, it costs a fraction. It's going to be canceled. Now, it's caught cost overruns. Its original cost was less than $1 billion. It's now going to cost between $6 and $7 billion over a decade. But that's small potatoes compared to each, you know, shuttle mission cost.
Yeah, definitely. Well, do you think that we should be preparing for human exploration, you know, past Earth orbit while we're sending, machines out to do some work?
Of course. I mean, well, it depends. You've got to decide your priorities of money. But it takes a long time and a lot of money to figure out how to send humans into orbit. I don't think private industry is the right way to do it. Though, into orbit, maybe, but not beyond Earth orbit. It's just too expensive. I think only governments can do that. I don't even see a business purpose for it. So I think we need to have a healthy program that's balanced, where we want to build these satellites that explore the nature of the universe and learn about life elsewhere in the universe and possible existence of Earth-like planets and the formation of the first stars and black holes. And, you know, those are fascinating questions, and we shouldn't cut those projects. But if at the same time we feel it's important for humans to eventually go to the moon or maybe Mars, although I've written it, I think the only sensible way to go to Mars is a one-way mission, not a round trip. It's much more economical, infinitely more economical.
Do you think it would be hard to find people to do it?
No, not only is it not hard, I've never found anyone who said they wouldn't.
Wow.
Among scientists or astronauts.
Let's talk about that. That's too interesting to just breeze over.
Okay.
So you actually talked to people about, would you go on a one-way trip to Mars?
I wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times called A One-Way Trip to Mars. And as part of that and following that, I got a lot of chance to talk to people. And I've talked to many scientists who said, now, saying you do it and doing it is a different story. And then when I wrote it, Buzz Aldrin got in touch with me and said, you know, he and many astronauts have been arguing for this. Because it's not like it's a suicide mission. I wasn't necessarily suggesting a suicide mission, although that wouldn't kill me either, because I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
But one of the things that's interesting is I estimated it would be a lot cheaper to send, you know, astronauts to Mars and even provision them. And then Buzz told me that Chris Kraft, who, if you're old enough, you'll remember from the Apollo missions, was in mission control, did an estimate that it would that to send a single crew to Mars and then keep sending them on manned spacecraft to provision them and build them would cost one-tenth. To get a single crew to Mars and provision them for the rest of their life, one-tenth of a single round-trip mission.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Really?
For the rest of their life.
Yeah. Why is the return trip so expensive?
Because it's a law of physics. Mm-hmm. Just simple. Fuel. Why fuel? Because you have to take the fuel that you need for the return trip on your way there. And but you need more fuel to carry the fuel because most of the mass of the ship is the fuel. So it's an exponential problem. That's not just the only problem, however. There's another problem, and that is we really don't know at this point how to protect astronauts from radiation, from cosmic rays.
That's a big problem.
And the trip there could be 6 months, but the trip back might be a lot longer. And the combined round trip would probably be fatal, or at least produce potentially lethal amounts of radiation. So so that's another reason to send them one way, I suppose. There's lots of arguments for it. It was a provocative argument, and I did it more to point out the difficulty of considering round trips than to necessarily argue it was the only hope. But I think, you know, what Buzz said again, he said, we shouldn't be defeatist about it. You know, John Kennedy said, you know, well, we're first in our generation to send a man to the moon and return him safely. But what you could say if you're president, I'm going to be the first president to make a permanent colony on another. Mm-hmm. You know, that just doesn't sound defeatist. It sounds positive.
Yeah, it does.
What about creating your fuel on Mars? The return trip fuel on Mars.
Bob Zubrin, as you may know, has been proposing that, and that's a very interesting possibility. You could, in principle, create fuel on Mars, bring it back, and that you might do that. But the point is that isn't logically or mutually inconsistent with sending one way trips. I mean, you might create fuel on Mars if you wanted to have an emergency vehicle back, or you could send crews that are there and bring some other people back. It's not mutually exclusive. Mm. The bottom line is that anything other than either one way or anything other than carrying only enough fuel to get you there seems economically difficult. And so whether you keep them there, whether you make the fuel on Mars to bring them back, I don't really know the point of bringing them back, but maybe. I mean, that's the other thing I pointed out is throughout human history, if you're really talking about explorers and not risk-averse accountants, you know, explorers throughout human history have been prepared, as have pilgrims and other people, The rule, rather than the exception, is to leave where you are for a new place without ever having the expectation of coming back.
Yeah. I think it is it's a very interesting idea, especially that you know, you've talked to some people that I would think the overwhelming response would be, I'm not doing that. You know?
No, it's amazing to me how many scientists and astronauts and engineers say, oh, I'd love to do that.
Yeah.
Talk about ending on a high note, ending your life on a high note.
Yeah, exactly.
That would be fantastic.
For a lot of people, exactly. It's a point in their life where they say, yeah, I could end my life exploring another planet. That's not so bad. I mean, for, you know, depending upon what you, you know, for some people, they might want to get out.
Lawrence, how many people would have to go on that initial mission?
Oh, I don't know. You have to think about that. You know, what's the minimal number of people who can have a reasonable, that you can accommodate and that have enough expertise and also enough social interaction to produce a reasonable, you know, group, you know, you'd have to do all of these studies. So it's hard to know what the number is.
That affects the cost.
Of course it does. But, you know, but the interesting thing is, you know, when I did this, I did a lot of radio programs and independently, the proposal was made three times by callers in different cities that it should be all women and that they should bring vials of sperm.
Wow.
And that's the way and the women would be better as a group than men. Anyway, I thought I don't have any views on that whatsoever, but it was interesting that at least some people thought that.
Lucky man.
Whatever.
All right, Lawrence, I'll do it.
That's you talking now.
we'd have to change the name of the planet though to Amazon.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So Amazonia. Lawrence, what would happen if they sent a bunch of people and you know they set up their society and they're building structures and we send them more stuff and they're using that and they're building it. And then you know, we suddenly lose touch with them. So we quickly get it. Wait, let me finish because this is really
you're
crazy. So we send another ship to Mars and the astronauts land and they just find these spacesuits ripped open with blood everywhere. And then, as you can see where I'm going with this.
The next script for a horror movie.
Yes.
Well, actually, it's the only piece I've ever written that was optioned for a movie. For that reason, the only not the only piece I've ever written, but the only newspaper it was in my op-ed piece was optioned for a movie. For yeah, it's very. If you start thinking about that possibility, and not just that, how you choose people and what their lives are and what the dynamics are, and whether there's a good, whether there's an evil person among the bunch, and all this, you know, you can imagine a long-running TV series. You know, you could imagine lots of things.
Oh,
and,
yeah, that would be actually super. I would see that, but you're writing to the, you know, to us, like maybe there's like 100 people that would be like, yeah.
Well, no, I think it'd be fascinating, and I, in Hollywood, if you're out there, you can contact me again,
Lawrence. And, a lot of times what we're saying goes back to cost, how much these things are going to cost. And a lot of times I think about this chemical rockets. Why are they still with us? I'm so frustrated that we still use chemical rockets, and we don't seem to be taking seriously the other possibilities, nuclear thermal, other ideas.
Nuclear scares people, but nuclear thermal is perfectly – and we are using it in satellites, and we're using – electromagnetic propulsion, and all of these things are being explored. Ion propulsion is, but the trouble is that, you know, they're great for satellites in a way because they have low thrust. What they eventually allow you to do is go to higher speeds
over time, and
that's much more important if you want to get somewhere quickly. And it's harder if you have a big payload, which involves humans. Humans have a big payload. Why? Because you got to have all the crap that goes along to keep the humans alive. That's why they're so damn expensive. But you're right. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that. What the president is suggesting, and what is not so crazy, that we might want to rethink and do research and development about new, instead of building Apollo vehicles again, that we might want to look at before we consider such horrendously expensive missions. We should put research and development money into new kinds of propulsion and new techniques that might, in the 21st century, allow you to do more efficiently interplanetary space travel at some level.
Do you think that overall we should just, you know, wait, essentially develop the technology to a later, more developed stage before we consider? Well, I think it's just premature to try to really do a serious long-term space man.
Well, there's lots of, you know, look, it's logistics. It's there's lots of things. You can't wait in a sense because you lose a generation. This would happen after Apollo. I mean, you've got engineers and you've got people like that, and unless you have some kind of goal and overriding mission that encourages young people to go into these areas of work, then you're not going to get the expertise to do it.
Right.
So at some level, even if it's long term, I think you do. You know, if you decided that's a priority, and as I say, it's not something that's automatic in my mind as a priority. But if that's a priority for the nation in some way, then you make it that way, and you make it inspirational so that people do it. And you may say it's a 25-year process, but I still think there are people who'd be inspired to be a part of that.
Thank you very much for sitting down with us.
Really appreciate
it.
Okay.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready?
Yes.
Yep.
We have a theme this week. The theme is yawning. All right, here we go. Item number one, contrary to popular belief, yawning has been shown to have an arousing rather than sleep-inducing effect. Item number two, a large study of yawning finds that yawns are significantly more contagious from family members and friends than acquaintances or strangers. And item number three, yawning has been observed in every class of vertebrates. Bob, go first.
Arousing rather than sleep-inducing effect. Interesting. The classic interpretation is that, what I've come across is that it helps synchronize sleep cycles, say, within a tribe of people. Yeah, that's not sure what to think of that one. They're more contagious from family members and friends. Yeah, I guess I could see that if there's any truth to the synchronization of sleep cycles, it would behoove you to synchronize with family and friends rather than strangers, if that's even true. But yawning in every class of vertebrates, yeah, I'm not buying that one. Yeah, I think it's probably very, very common, but every class, I think that's kind of rubbing me the wrong way. I'm not sure why, but it wouldn't surprise me if there were some types of vertebrates that are just different in that regard. I'm going to say that one's fiction.
Okay, Jay.
So the one about yawning waking you up rather than making you fall asleep. Okay, all right. I mean, now that I think about it, maybe yawning helps you stay awake. That's interesting, even though it still inadvertently would be a sign of sleep, that you need to do something to help you stay awake. The second one about yawning finds that yawns are significantly more contagious from people that you know. I can't think of any reason why that would be happening other than the idea that like if you're with your tribe, it could be like a sign that it's time to sleep. And you know how women, they say that women that spend time together, their periods will sync up. You know, maybe this is one of those effects, which is interesting. And then the last one, the one about yawning has been observed in every class of vertebrates. Sure. Okay. It's so easy for you to say, but the freaking porcupine doesn't yawn. You know, I don't know. That's, I mean, you got me on that one, Steve. I guess I'm going to go with that last one as the fake.
The class of vertebrates?
Yeah.
Okay. Rebecca?
For me, this is just process of elimination, because as for yawning waking you up, that's something that I've thought to be true for quite a while. I'm pretty sure studies have shown that in the past, that they wake you up. Yeah, they make you more alert. And also the idea that yawns are more contagious in family groups, that makes perfect sense because of previous theories that yawns are a way of sort of in-group socialization. And those two things together would indicate that yawning could help keep your entire group awake and alert during important times, you know, when you're being stalked by a saber-toothed tiger or whatever. So that just leaves the idea that yawning has been observed in every class of vertebrates as being the only one that must be false.
Okay, Evan.
This rousing effect rather than sleep inducing. Sure, because perhaps I know when I yawn, all right, I have my yawn, right, my nice big yawn, and then I kind of at the very end of the yawn, I shake a little bit, almost like open my eyes a little bit wider as to say, okay, stay awake. That would help you stay awake rather than induce sleep. The second one about being more contagious from family members and friends, a lot of the reasons everyone else said I agree with. I don't think this is limited to something like yawning. I think there are studies of that shows that family members probably do lots of different things would be considered maybe contagious just because of that sort of group tribe things that we, you know, subconscious things that we really don't think about, but we've been doing it for many, 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 many generations. So that's why I think that one is true. That does leave the last one, yawning being observed in every class of vertebrates. Every is, you know, a lot. I imagine you mean non-extinct classes of vertebrates. So I won't go so far as to say that, you know, extinct ones, how do they really know if there's any notes about them yawning or not? But I'm not even going to go that far, but I'll say
yes,
that one's
extant,
as well.
Ones that can be observed. This is sort of implied. Okay.
Or have been observed, but.
Yeah, right. Not dinosaurs.
Right.
Okay, so you all agree that three is the fiction. So let's take these in order. We'll start with number one. Contrary to popular belief, yawning has been shown to have an arousing rather than a sleep-inducing effect. You all think that is science. And that one is the fiction.
Wow.
What?
Oh, yeah.
What?
Oh,
bastard.
Yes.
Oh, you swept us.
I did. I did sweep you with the yawning.
Like a chimney sweep on the rooftops of London.
So that was, however, a hypothesis about yawning. First of all, it's been observed that people yawn as much when waking up as when feeling sleepy or going to sleep, and they yawn at other times of day as well. There's no real special relationship between yawning and being sleepy. The theory was that perhaps yawning stretches the tendons of the jaw and has an alerting effect, but there have been lots of studies looking at this and several recent reviews that all agree that no physiological effect has been actually clearly shown with scientific evidence to be the consequence of yawning. So we haven't been able to link any physiological effect, including specifically being alerted or aroused. The evidence just doesn't support it. The bottom line is we don't know why people yawn. There's still plenty of room for speculation about does it have some effect on the lungs? You know, does it open up the airways in the lungs a little bit better? It's not. I think a lot of people. I've heard this from many people. I think that a lot of people think that it has to do with oxygen or something or getting more air, but that's not true. Mm. That's, I think that's clearly not true. Take any time when you take a deep breath, that does help open up, you know, the little air sacs in the lungs. Sighing would do it. Just taking a deep breath would do it. So yawning isn't special in that way, but it could also serve that purpose.
Yawning involves jaw motion, movement of the head,
yeah,
right, and throat. So it, that has to be part
well,
of the
no, it doesn't. Doesn't
equation.
Have to because well, here's why. And this is there's a lot of this exact debate going on in the literature, and that is, can we really come up with a very specific adaptationalist interpretation of why we yawn? And maybe not, you know, and we'll get to that more when we talk about the third item. Let's move on to number two. A large study of yawning finds that yawns are significantly more contagious from family members and friends than acquaintances or strangers, and that one is science. That was the new news item in the lineup. And that's interesting, and in fact it was family greater than friends, greater than acquaintances, greater than strangers. And Evan, you hit upon the fact that this is part of a more generalizable principle that we are, and this is the effect here is labeled as an empathy effect, that we tend to be much more affected and clued into the emotional state of people that we have a connection to, rather than acquaintances or strangers. So this yawning contagion, so that's clearly established. It's like almost the only thing we could say for sure about yawning is that it's contagious. And it's contagious not just in humans, but in other animals as well. Although not all animals who yawn show the contagiousness of yawning. It's definitely in non-human primates and in some other species. You guys all, you know, talked about the fact that maybe this has to do with socialization, with, you know, sinking ourselves emotionally or whatever with our tribe members, and that is the standard interpretation that this is an empathy effect, and it kind of follows the same pattern that other things, which are also have to do with, you know, emotionally empathizing with people that we feel close to. So that one is science, which brings us to the third one. Yawning has been observed in every class of vertebrates, and that is science. Now, what that means is that this is a very primitive, if you will, a very phylogenetically ubiquitous or early phenomenon, that something that developed very early in the vertebrate line. There were some sources that said simply all vertebrates. But that seemed a little hard to substantiate, you know, every single species of vertebrate. And in fact, I found one published article that made the observation that certain species of frogs and other amphibians perhaps don't yawn, that they haven't been observed to yawn. So I think the more conservative statement, which I found multiple sources for, is that every class of vertebrates. So if you look at the large groups that have been observed to yawn.
Maybe it's the appendix of behavior, right? Maybe there was a reason way back when that it was a necessity to yawn, but we no longer really need it.
I wouldn't go as far as to call it vestigial, but it may not serve necessarily the function that it originally evolved for. It could be that it's just something, it's a very primitive reflex that is so ingrained in just the vertebrate central nervous system that it will not easily be lost. And maybe different species find different uses for it. That's the current thinking. It's something like that, that we don't necessarily say that it evolved for a specific purpose. It looks to be something that's been pretty well conserved in the vertebrate, you know, branch. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't serve any purpose, because you know, evolution makes use of what's there, and it's there. But the interesting thing is that after a lot of studies, you know, we really just don't know why we yawn and if it does serve any adaptive function and if there is any physiological effect of it. Nothing has been established scientifically. But yeah, I found it very interesting that it is so widely distributed a phenomenon among vertebrates, though. That's very interesting.
That is admittedly interesting.
We learned something.
You're basically just as bad as Kevin Trudeau.
You did not just pull that line.
Let's not argue over who swept who.
Everyone's a winner. All right. Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
I have a quote that was sent in by a guy named Bo Walbridge. And this is actually a quote from someone that we interviewed at TAM in 2010. And that interview appeared on our podcast number 269, Carol Tavris. You guys remember Carol?
Yeah.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, Carol Tavris.
How could we forget?
Still remember.
Carol is an American social physiologist and author. She received a PhD in social psychology from the University of Michigan and has taught psychology at the University of California, Los Angeles, and the New School for Social Research. She's crazy cool. I loved our interview with her. And now that I'm reminded of her, I want to go back and re-listen to it.
She's awesome.
This quote is from the book Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. And that book was written by Carol and Elliot Aronson. Rebecca, you ready for this one?
I'm ready. Give it to me.
The scientific method consists of the use of procedures designed to show not that our predictions and hypotheses are right, but that they might be wrong. Science reasoning is useful to anyone in any job because it makes us face the possibility, even the dire reality, that we were mistaken. It forces us to confront our self-justifications and put them on public display for others to puncture. At its core, therefore, science is a form of arrogance control.
Carol Tavris.
Carol Tavris!
Thank you, Jay. So it is that time of year again, guys.
The end of
the time when you all get me presents.
Presents in the form of our end of the year, best of 2011 wrap-up episode. Hooray! This is the episode's coming up. It'll be the last episode of the year where we review all of the best parts of the SGU over 2011. But we need your help, dear
help
listeners.
Us.
We need you to email us or join us on the forums and put it there. Post it there. Your vote for your favorite episode, your favorite interview, the funniest moments from the SGU 2011, your favorite science news item from 2011, the worst gaffe or the stupidest thing that someone said over the past year, and anything else that you would like to reminisce about or remember about the SGU or science or skepticism over 2011. Send it in, and we'll talk about it.
Steve, our listeners can go to our forums, and they could look up a topic called 2011 Show Wrap-Up Special.
That's right, or just email us, or you tweet it to us. We always have a lot of fun with that, that episode every year. And we will be joined, as we always are, by Mike Lassell, who does a lot of work for the SGU over the year. Yeah.
Mike is a key player behind the scenes, and we honor him by bringing him on that show.
So thanks for joining me again this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you,
thanks, Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.